This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Russian invasion of Ukraine created great concern around the world, and it's easy to imagine the ultimate aims of the aggression as a lust for territorial expansion and resources. But what triggers such an event? When does a leader like Vladimir Putin decide to send his military across a border? Jeffrey Berejikian is a professor of international affairs at the University of Georgia, and he thinks the answer may be found through cognitive science, particularly in studies on how individuals respond to loss. And this theory won't just tell us about Putin, it may also help us understand decisions made right here in the United States. Jeffrey Berejikian joins us today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. You've established these cognitive science ideas, and you start applying them to international affairs. And one of the ideas is something called prospect theory. What is that?
Yeah, well, prospect theory and, as you sort of mentioned, loss aversion are two distinct but really related aspects of human decision making. They've been observed for a long time in the laboratory, out in the real world, really across cultures and, I guess, a wide variety of different contexts. And loss aversion, which is sort of the foundation of this, really just captures the basic intuition that losses hurt more than gains feel good. And that's another way of saying that the negative emotional impact of a loss for most people is greater than the positive emotional impact of a gain. So anecdotally, I guess, if you think about walking to the coffee shop and you find $20 on the sidewalk, that's going to feel really good. On the other hand, if you get to the coffee shop and you realize that you've lost $20, that feels really, really bad. And it turns out this sort of asymmetric emotional response doesn't just affect how we feel about, you know, gains and losses and when we take risks. It also affects our behavior. And so because the emotional cognitive sting of loss is so much greater, we try much harder to avoid losses or to recover from a loss than is sometimes rational. And so again, to the $20, if you found $20 on your way to the coffee shop, you might go back once and hope that you find another $20. But if you'd lost $20 on your way to the coffee shop, you might go back 3 or 4 or 5 days in a row at exactly the same time and hope the $20 blows out from under a rock. And so this affects a broad spectrum of human behavior, and research on everything from your choice of pizza toppings to stock market behavior shows evidence of loss aversion. And we think it plays a role in foreign policy as well.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. And I think at one point you talked about the intuitive sense that loss hurts more than or has a deeper effect than gain. Although I don't know if that's intuitive. I mean, to some extent, we think about positive reinforcement, right, and conditioning having to do with, you know, sort of praise being. And I think what's at the root of that is the sense that that saying something nice about something, somebody will have the same effect as, you know, sort of punishing them for doing the wrong thing. But you're saying that actually that punishment prints more strongly, that it stays with us in a more lasting and powerful way.
It does. Both gains and losses are important, and gains can be used to motivate people, to get them to want to do things. I think that the key with respect to losses is exactly in the term loss aversion. It's this powerful aversion that's located in sort of deep in the old parts of the brain. It's very similar to the aversion we have to other kinds of very negative emotions. It's very similar to the reaction we have to pain. And so if we're trying to get people to do things, we can do it in either way. We can encourage them to do it with good words or positive incentives, as you suggested. But if we can create an aversion, we can prevent them from engaging in activity. And actually, it's a little bit easier to get them to avoid something than it is to get somebody to do something they wouldn't otherwise do.
So our memory of loss is stronger and more powerful. And I think another example of this is gamblers who sort of irrationally stay at the table when they're on the downside, huh?
Yeah, Vegas. Well, so there's two parts to this. Vegas kind of lives on this. If you are encouraged to lay down that first bet because there are bright lights or they're offering free alcohol or whatever it is, once you lay down that first bet, you're sort of confronted with a classic, what we call a loss frame choice, and this gets closer to prospect theory. But you now can either accept this gamble where you're going to have to lay down more money to make up the money you just lost, or you can just walk away having lost 10 or 15 bucks at the roulette table. And so what we find is that people tend to chase against the initial loss, the initial bad bet, with more bad bets. And, you know, if it weren't for this kind of a dynamic, yeah, Vegas wouldn't exist. On the other hand, people who are sort of habitual gamblers and who have a problem, and it can be really devastating sometimes with gambling and other kinds of behaviors like this, actually have a slightly different kind of brain. And so the front part of their brain that sort of processes rewards is overactive, and they're sort of a little bit different. They're chasing these good feelings. But for most of us, yeah, losses really do hurt more than gains feel good.
All right. So we've been talking about prospect theory and some of these other aspects of cognitive science. How does this relate to Vladimir Putin's decision to send his troops across the border?
Yeah, well, and this is where I sort of depart a bit from the conventional wisdom, which suggests that what Russia was doing was taking advantage of American weakness. So that story goes that if the West had been able to craft an effective deterrence package, that Russia wouldn't have moved into Crimea. And the story goes that this didn't happen. Somehow Putin sensed this weakness and took advantage of it for this strategic and political victory. This wasn't a victory or a success for Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. I think actually it was a rather desperate and risky attempt to recover some of the losses that in status and prestige and political influence that the Russian government has recently suffered as the Yanukovych government collapsed. Look, the turmoil in Ukraine has undermined a friendly government to Russia. That's now gone. Their political influence is gone. It's pushed the rest of Ukraine, it looks like, closer to the West. There's a good chance that Russia is going to have to subsidize the Crimean economy for a while. The Ukraine is going to eventually stand up its own independent military. And so as the position, the Russian position in Ukraine deteriorated, Putin could have chosen a number of other strategies, a negotiation strategy backed up by threats, for example, which would have been a much less risky kind of policy to adopt. But he didn't. I think this is pretty consistent with loss aversion and the fact that when we're confronted with losses, people really are much more acceptant of risks. And it looks like that's the case here.
Is there any way to tell, because you're obviously working from cognitive theories that deal mostly with how individuals respond to these situations, any way to tell for instance, does it matter if you're in a democracy where popular attention and popular will makes a difference to that leader, whether or not you stay in power? You have to bring the folks along with you, and do they have to feel the same loss? And do you as a political leader have to understand that your folks are feeling the same way you are? Or is this one individual's particular, a quirk in an individual?
That's actually a great question, and the answer is that it works sort of both ways. One of the things that we're beginning to find is that the primary benefit in this area of democracy is that the competition between political groups in a democracy serve as effective counter-framers. And so loss aversion and this risk acceptance that comes from loss aversion, that sort of breaks down when you're forced to confront a problem from a number of different competing perspectives. The older emotional centers of the brain aren't processing the choice. The newer frontal parts of the brain become more active. And so as you're forced to look at a problem from a number of different perspectives, which is exactly what democratic competition does, loss aversion and framing effects sort of diminish. And so this is sort of a good story about the role that democracy can play. It's not an inoculant against bad decisions. It doesn't prevent bad foreign policy decisions, but they're less likely where you have this kind of counterframing than in regimes where the leaders are isolated from competing points of view or are isolated from meaningful domestic political competition. And that's one of the things that, you know, I think we've seen Vladimir Putin be very successful at, which is shielding himself from meaningful political competition and surrounding himself with people who agree with his rule and who aren't willing to challenge him. And so in some ways, it's not terribly surprising that, for example, the preferences of other groups in Russia, the oligarchs who see this as a bad thing, for example, aren't having an impact on the way he thinks about the problem.
So it's as though our triune brain, that sort of reptilian, mammalian, and sort of frontal cortex that we now understand as the kind of the three big parts of the brain, stand as a kind of type for a democratic debate that goes on. And if you had a dominant reptilian brain, the rest of it went to sleep, you'd have a kind of totalitarian government where nobody's paying attention to the rest of it.
Well, yeah, I mean the fact that we're being forced to look at a problem from different perspectives and think about gains and losses requires a lot of cognitive effort. And so because it requires a lot of cognitive effort, the part of our brain that does that turns on, and the older reptilian part of the brain quiets down. And so the argument is that democratic competition is one way to force leaders to look at things from a number of competing perspectives where they might otherwise not, and therefore might be more likely to fall into a dominant frame, for example, a loss frame, which might lead them astray.
Jeffrey Berejikian is a professor of international affairs at the University of Georgia. Thank you so much. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.